Good morning again, and happy Epiphany. Today is January 6th. That's Epiphany. Happens to fall on a Sunday this year. If you're curious, Epiphany is today that the church traditionally celebrates the visit of the wise men, the magi, to come visit Jesus. Yesterday was January 5th, the last day of Christmas, the 12th day of Christmas, so today is the first day of, well, not Christmas. Not really the most joyous of holidays, is it? It is the day, though, that you traditionally take down your Christmas decorations because it's no longer Christmas. Which leads us right into what I want to talk about. The New Year is also the first Sunday of the New Year. The holidays are behind us, and now we're approaching the New Year season. 2012 was quite a year. It was the year for me that I turned 34. It means I need to repent for not being Christ-like. I'll give you all a moment and let that sink in. Sounds like three of you got it. That's great. Christ lived to be 33, by the way. It's also a day where we survived an apocalypse just a few weeks ago. That was kind of a letdown of an apocalypse, wasn't it? In fact, if you go back 2 years, we've survived three apocalypses in the last 2 years, two of which include the rapture. We've missed two raptures, and we're all still here. What does that tell you about us as a church, huh? I don't know about y'all. I wasn't running around panicking and screaming when the apocalypse was coming. I doubt very many of us were. And I would wager to say the reason for that is because we approached the apocalypses with a healthy skepticism, a healthy sense of doubt. And that's actually, on this New Year's service, what I'd like to talk about is doubt. This is New Year, so over the last week and over the next couple weeks, many personal and group resolutions will be made. And most of those, to be frank, are not going to survive. But those that we do keep are going to result in happier lives, more purposeful lives, more intentional lives, and ideally more godly lives. And as we are on this cusp of a new beginning, a new year, a new time to start over, so to speak, I considered myself as a pastor, what were the things I would like to impart as part of a fresh beginning? What would I want someone who is beginning anew to know? What would enable them and empower them to begin anew with greater strength, with greater likelihood of success? And so I want to talk about actually a fairly heavy topic, the topic of doubt. It's very near and dear to me, very important to me. This subject informs a lot of my ministry. So ideally, with any sermon, with any text, with any service, we are brought nearer to the heart of God. But as a side note, not intentionally, but as a side note, throughout this sermon, you hopefully will become a little bit closer to the heart of Mike, at least understanding why one of your ministers does what he does. And it's largely because of doubt. Doubt is something that each of us will deal with in this coming year. It's not simply a crisis of faith. It's a crisis of relationship. That's how I'm going to be defining doubt. It's a crisis of relationship. And in that vein, all of us are going to see it over the next year. Jason, I'm not sure that my thing is working. Well, I'll keep going. Nice. All right, where was I? I was here, I think. Okay. Doubt as a crisis of relationship is something that we will deal with not just once, but multiple times over the coming year. To help you understand and make sure we're on the same page, I want to give you a couple examples, a couple of broad definitions of doubt that would help us apply it personally before we really delve into the meat of how we're going to handle it. Okay? Let me give you a couple examples. And hopefully by defining it this way, you can have a couple aha moments of, okay, I see what he's talking about when he means doubt. The first way that we will face doubt in this coming year is we will doubt other people. We will doubt what they do. I'm still not working. There we go. We will doubt other people. We have relationships, and a damaged relationship is hard to repair. What's the expression? You fool me once, shame on you. You fool me twice, shame on me. I like the ending of that. You fool me 1,000 times, you're a weatherman. I always kind of like that. That second part scares us. Because then you fool me twice, Shame on you. When we are hurt, we don't want to fall in that trap of getting fooled twice. We put up a wall. And it's not just in the relationship that's actually damaged. It can affect other ones. If a good friend betrays you, it can make it harder to get closer to other people. God forbid if that's a spouse or a family member that you feel betrayed by. So we can doubt other people. We can also doubt humanity as a whole. We can doubt our world. You don't have to turn on the news to see that. School shootings involving children. The response to these not being much better. I don't know if you've watched the news much since then, but everyone's got a solution, and their solution usually involves the people that disagree with them being evil and wicked. And the hate-filled stuff that they share. I mean, if you're worried about the world looking bad, don't ever look at a map of the Middle East. Violence is a regular part of life there. And even when there's not physical violence, the hate, the vitriol seems even worse. So we doubt humanity. And then that brings us to what we're talking about next. When I say doubt, you're probably thinking of a crisis of faith. And that is one way that we doubt. We doubt our faith. Allow me to use seminary speak for a minute. The way we described a crisis of faith in seminary was when your faith no longer had explanatory power. What I mean by that is your faith explains the world to you. We have a way of viewing the world as a Christian. We have a biblical way of viewing the world. And sometimes you come up against stuff that you see in the world that does not match the way your belief says it should. That leads to a crisis of faith. In other words, wait, that's not the way it's supposed to be. There's something wrong here. The world's not supposed to work this way. Crisis of faith can also be a personal crisis. Am I good enough crisis? How could God forgive me? How could God care about me? How can God use me? I'm so inadequate. Am I good enough? Which leads me to the fourth thing. Sometimes we doubt our God. That's not asking, am I good enough? It's asking, is he good enough? A lot of the classical questions come from this doubt. How can a good God let bad things happen? Does God even care about me? Does God hear me? Now, some of these are more frequent than others, but you will deal with one of these doubts in the coming year. A doubt that is a crisis of relationship with another person, with your faith, with your God. Now, so far, this has been kind of a downer of a sermon. Let me bracket it a little bit, okay? We're going to stop here. We're going to step over here. There's a reason why it's a downer of a sermon. I'm talking about doubt, and doubt always seems bad, always seems negative. What I want to do is encourage us to acknowledge that doubt is not bad. Doubt is very, very, very good. And there is a reason for it. Now, it can cause bad things to happen. But I want to offer you a lot of encouragement and say, hey, it's not just, oh, we're going to have to deal with doubts in the coming year. I'm ready to deal with doubts in the coming year. It's a big difference. First point of encouragement, I'll give you four, just to kind of let you know where I'm going. The first point of encouragement is that doubt and faith are not opposites. They are not opposites. We often think that they are. There are a lot of passages in the Bible that sometimes we think, well, that means doubt is just the first step towards unbelief. You have faith, you have doubt, and then it's a slippery slope down to unbelief, to disbelief. Well, doubt is not disbelief. In fact, in a lot of English translations, the word that's translated doubt really means disbelief, which is different. Doubt is uncertainty. These biblical passages that seem to look down on doubt are a little more complicated. Let me give you three of the commonly known examples. Anyone heard of a guy named Thomas? You know, John chapter 20, doubting Thomas. That's what he's famous for. Poor guy. He just happened to be out getting pizza when the other disciples saw Jesus. He came back, and he said, we saw the risen Lord. He said, I won't believe it until I see him with my own eyes. So Jesus appeared to him, said, look at the wounds on my hands. Look at my side. Do not doubt, but believe. Well, actually, do not disbelieve, but believe. Remember the story of Jesus and the fig tree? I love that story. He got mad at a fig tree, and he cursed the tree, and the tree died. His disciples were amazed. They turned to them and said, if you believe and do not doubt, you can do the same thing. Remember that story of Peter and Jesus walking on the water? And Peter started to sink. So Jesus pulled him out of the water and he said, you have so little faith. Why did you doubt? Sounds like doubt's a bad thing, doesn't it? We're talking about disbelief here. And there's always a red flag to know when you're talking about disbelief and not doubt. In every case, they saw their evidence and they continued to disbelieve. Jesus did not say, "Do not doubt," to Thomas before he showed back up. He said, "Here, look at me, look at the wounds. Now, do not disbelieve." Peter had already seen his evidence. He already saw Jesus walking on the water. He already saw himself walking on the water. The disciples had seen Jesus curse the fig tree and saw it wither. We're talking about disbelief, not doubt. By contrast, when the Bible talks about doubt, it's a lot more charitable. Jude 22 says, "Have mercy upon those who doubt." In the text you read earlier, when Habakkuk complained to God, God did not smack him down. He did not chastise him. Now, he did say, "Okay, I'm doing a little bit more than you could possibly comprehend." But he accepted that. He encouraged Habakkuk. Even gave him advice. "In the meantime, the righteous shall live by faith." That's where that famous verse comes from. Remember when Jesus was ready to face his trial on the cross? He struggled, didn't he? In the Garden of Gethsemane? Don't think he struggled with belief. But he was struggling with his mission. He was wrestling with his God. When he's on the cross, he quoted Psalm 22. My God, why have you forsaken me?" God doesn't condemn the psalmist. He didn't condemn Jesus on the cross. You must remember that Jesus is 100% God, but he was also 100% human. And the Bible says that he was tempted just as we are. He had the same weaknesses. He simply overcame them. If he overcame his weaknesses and he had a struggle on the cross and in the Garden of Gethsemane, that implies very strongly to me that struggle is not the problem. Faith and doubt are not opposites. In fact, I would argue that doubt is an essential component of faith. Leads me to point number two, kind of an outgrowth of the first one. Our doubt is a sign of spiritual growth and not of spiritual weakness. You know, in church, when you have a doubt, when you have a struggle in any situation, in a relationship with your spouse, with a friend, sometimes we're loath to share it because we feel like, "Oh, this means I'm weak. Stronger Christian would know how to handle this, would know how to do this," right? Stronger Christians don't doubt. Baby Christians don't doubt. Let me give you an easy example that won't really offend anybody, and that shouldn't scare anyone because we're all moved past it. I don't know what you believed when you were a child, but children, little children, often have very funny ideas about God and the weather. The rain is God crying. Thunder is when the angels are bullying. They get a strike. It's thunder, right? That's a natural thing for kids to believe. And then as they get older, they start to think about it, start to have doubts. Huh. If rain is God crying, why is there so much rain everywhere? He must be awfully sad. Why is he raining everywhere at once? Is it like Santa Claus? He just runs everywhere to cry really quick so that everywhere gets rain? What about hurricanes and tornadoes then? Is that God sneezing? Why wouldn't he cover his mouth if he knows all the trouble that's going to cause? They'll seem like silly questions to us, but they're good questions for a kid. And as a result of those doubts, that kid doubting about what he believes, giving him the ability to explain what he sees. In other words, he believes that rain is God crying. What he sees is storms and rain everywhere and these other factors, and what he believes does not explain that anymore. So he comes up with better ideas. Wait a minute. God's not part of the world. He made the world. He's not part of it. So why would rain be him crying? He's not really up there crying. Or maybe they come to discover how God made our world, how he gave us weather systems and clouds to give us rain. The end result is that he understands God better. He knows that God is not just, you know, when I was five, God, he's the old man in the clouds. As I doubted that, I learned more fully how to appreciate him and understand him. And that's what doubt does to our faith. It is a sign of growth. I would go so far as to make this strong statement. You show me a Christian man who has never had any doubts, and I will show you a Christian baby. I know the initial response, Christ said, let the children come to me, you must have faith like a child. Which is true, we must trust God like a child. But the Bible also says we need to move from milk to meat. And if you do not doubt, if you have no doubts, you will never move off your milk. The author of Hebrews 6 is very, almost vicious about this. He says, let us move past the elemental doctrines of Christ and move on to maturity. And he goes on to list several things they've been debating, things that were important for a first century church. Don't get me wrong. Things like ritual washings and how to, you know, incorporate old Jewish practices with the new ones. But he finally says, that's enough. We've been dealing with this for long enough. You need to move on. It'd be like if I invited some of y'all over to a Bible study at my home and we talk about salvation. Dude, salvation's important, isn't it? Knowing how to get right with God, that is important. Hard to find something more important. You know, trusting in Christ is the very foundation of our faith. But what if that was the only thing we studied week after week after week after week after week? Eventually, we have to say, look, we're saved. We need to move on, get some meat. Talk about how can we live a life that is fulfilling to Christ? How can we honor him through our actions? How can we become more mature Christians? And doubt is what leads us to that. The idea that what we are doing is not perfect. Doesn't mean what you're doing is wrong. It does maybe mean it's time to grow up and move on. There's one of the side notes that's not obvious in the Bible that I think is incredible. Very beginning of the Bible, humanity's kind of mucking the whole world up. So God chooses one nation to be his people and through them to bless the rest of the world. You know what he names them? Genesis 32, he names them. He names them Israel. Israel means he who struggles with God. Kind of a telling name. These are God's people? The ones who wrestle with him? If you know that story of the original Israel, Jacob, whose name became Israel, physically wrestled with a man who he thought was God. The Bible's kind of vague on that issue. But God's chosen people, named by him, were given the name the ones who struggle with God. I even wondered how that seemed like in the ancient Near Eastern context. Come, join us in our worship, we who are struggling with God. We don't have all the answers. Probably never will. Faith and doubt are not opposites. That's number one. Number two, faith is a sign of spiritual growth. Doubt is a sign of spiritual growth, not of weakness. Thirdly, our doubt enables us to minister to other people. If I tried to find maybe the three or four couples among you that have been married the longest, and I asked you, what makes your marriage so strong? You know what I think we would hear? We'd hear stories about the problems they had and how they overcame them. If I asked you to tell me what made you the Christian you are today, how has God brought you to where you are, you'd probably tell me, some good things, but a lot of stories about how you have struggled with things in your life and God has brought you through it. Our doubts make us who we are today. I find it kind of funny sometimes that when you say you're a minister, it's almost hilarious. People's behavior changes right away. You know, you go into a restaurant, everyone's kind of doing the good old boy, you know, with the loose lips and the not real clean language. And like, hey, how are you doing? Like, hey, I'm Pastor Mike. And they straighten up. You know, they got food inside their mouth, they wipe it off, and they start talking all holy. I always find that kind of interesting. The opposite is true, too. People don't often want to share their doubts and concerns about faith to a minister. Maybe they're scared that they'll upset us, shock us. Believe it or not, we hear a lot of them. Believe it or not, we've had a lot of them. I'm not a minister today because, I figured out Christ when I was baptized at 11, and here I am. It's been a process since then. I've had doubts. I've wrestled with them. Come up with answers. Not always, but sometimes. And when I do come up with answers, I understand God a little bit more. My old doubts are now my new ministry tools. Your old doubts, your old struggles are your ministry tools. If you've had troubles in your marriage, you are uniquely gifted to minister to someone else who's had the same troubles in their marriage. You struggled with how can God be loving if he lets bad things happen? You are now qualified to minister to someone who is struggling with the same thing right now. Our old doubts are our new ministry tools. They enable us to minister to other people. And finally, this is not necessarily encouragement so much as a reminder. There really isn't an easy path to the answers you want. I don't know what comes to your head when I mention the word doubts. Let me share with you what it was like for me when I was younger. I felt that doubt meant that you didn't understand everything yet. And so I'd frantically look for that answer, like I'm missing a puzzle piece. And, oh, I found it. That's really not how doubt works. I'm not a huge fan of Oscar Wilde and his lifestyle, but he has a quote that I absolutely love. It says, "The truth is rarely pure and never simple." Now, this might shock you, but God is a little bit too big for us to understand. God's word has a little bit more in it than I will ever wrap my brain around. There will never be a point in my life where I'm like, all right, got it figured out. I was baptized at 11, I'm 34 now. It took me 23 years, but I'm good. That day will never happen. But what does happen is I become more and more aware of who God is, what he wants for me, what his vision is for my life. And I do that every time I have a doubt. If you allow me to paraphrase Lee, I will never become perfectly Christ-like. Neither will you. We will never perfectly understand the will of God. But we should die trying. It takes a certain amount of maturity to accept that. This is never necessarily going to make perfect sense to us this side of heaven. There will be questions that we'll be asking God when we get there, because we simply can't answer them here. That said, doubt is a healthy part of the growing process. Doubt can transform all of our relationships in positive ways. If you doubt in a relationship, it means that you acknowledge that that person is a sinner. Your friend, your spouse, your parent. Guess what? They're a sinner. They need Christ just as much as you do. And having a more healthy, appropriate appreciation for who they are can help you deal with that. Like, wow, you actually did something really bad to me. But I've done that to people too. So instead of me expecting you to be perfect, let's move on from there. It helps you understand the world, that the world, apart from the Prince of Peace, the world will never know peace. We should not expect to see peace where Christ is not present. Hopefully that will reinvigorate us to spread the gospel and kingdom of Christ to where there is no peace right now. As regard to doubts about faith, it will help us understand more fully that we don't understand fully. Common example I use is from the book of Proverbs. Raise up a child in the way he shall go. He will not depart from it. I've known good Christian parents. Kids that have departed from the Christian walk. It's almost like we want to pretend that if you raise your child right, then you can make the choice for them to accept Christ. You can't. Each of us accepts Christ on our own. And when we wrestle with that, we understand that, okay, God does not want me to dominate my child. He wants me to guide my child. That's a healthier understanding of what God expects. And finally, when it comes to God, doubt means that, well, in a nutshell, he is God, and I'm not. And if I don't understand what he is doing, well, it's not exactly his problem. I've used this example a lot, but it's very pertinent to my life. Being a parent has transformed how I view faith, by the way. And there are so many things that I have to discipline my children on that they just don't understand. I can't explain to my one-year-old the dangers of a car and how they can't walk out in the street. I just say, don't do it. And I'm sure from her perspective, little Tan's perspective, it's, wow, Daddy's mean. He won't let me go out there. He'll spank me if I go out there. I'm not allowed to touch the stove. I'm not allowed to jump headfirst in the bathtub. Well, you and I are Tatum, and God is the daddy. And we're not allowed to jump in the bathtub headfirst. We're not allowed to touch the stove or walk in the street. May not know why, but our daddy does. And I don't have to have all the answers. Let me end it this way. Jesus had 12 disciples, 11 of which became the first apostles. Let me ask you a question. This is all preference. There's no right answer. Feel free to shout it out or just keep it to yourself. But if you had to pick one of the 11 disciples, I'm not going to count Judas, because, I mean, come on, he's Judas. One of the 11 apostles. Which one of those 11, first 11, would you say had the strongest faith? If you had to pick one that you think had the strongest faith, which one you get the best faith? Which one of them was it?
Peter.
Peter? Yeah. Thomas. Okay. John. John. Okay. So there's no wrong answer. So if you disagree with me, you're not wrong. But I lean towards Nicole. I pick Thomas. Think, what? Doubting Thomas? So we remember John 20. We forget John 11. Remember John 11? The story of Lazarus coming back to life. Jesus raised him. Great story. We ignore the first part of it. Jesus is being pursued by certain Jewish leaders that want to put him to death. And he is told Lazarus is going to die. After some discussion, he says, well, let's go back to Bethany and let's bring him back to life. And the disciples say, are you crazy? They're trying to kill you. Well, all but one of them say that. Thomas differs. He does not say, oh, the Lord will provide. We have the Jesus with us. God will protect us. Jesus knows what he's doing. He doesn't give a platitude. He doesn't say, let's just be trusting and move forward. No, you know what he says? Just let us go and die with him. Now, Thomas didn't die there. He died later. By tradition, he went to India and was stabbed by a native priest. Died on the end of a spear. You ever heard that expression, at the end of a spear, that's where that comes from. Thomas traditionally died at the end of a spear because he upset the religious order in India. He didn't die here, though, but he was ready to. And of all the sayings of all the apostles, I don't know of any stronger statement of faith than what Thomas said in John 11. Okay, he's going to die. Let's go die with him. Before I had kids, I was ready to say that. Well, I admit, I struggle a little bit. Went from, Lord, I'm ready, take me, to, let's wait a little bit. Wait till my kids are 18. Wait, you know what? And that is a doubt I have. God, you're going to take care of my family without me? God, you're going to take care of my church without me? Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I do know he's the daddy, and I'm the Tatum. So I'm pretty sure he's got it well in hand, a bit more than I do. So let me give you an unusual invitation this morning. You ready to doubt God? You ready to wrestle with those doubts? Open them up to God and say, God, I need your help. God, I need you to direct me and guide me because I don't have all the answers. I don't have it figured out, and I want to know more. I want to wrestle with you like your people did for thousands of years, like the church has for 2,000 years, and Israel did beforehand. I'm not talking about, you know, the idea of adoptionism right now. In a very real way, the church is Israel because we continue to wrestle with God. So as we approach this new year, as we step forward, you will face doubts in all your relationships with your faith, with your God, with the people in your life. The question is, are you ready to wrestle? Are you ready to be Israel? Are you ready to be honest with God? Say, God, I need your help. I need you to guide me. I need you to direct me. Because I sure don't get it.